Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Another weekend where some just horrific stories about shootings in Minneapolis, including two pregnant women shot, another homicide victim. Crime in Minneapolis still at the top of mind. And a report has been released by a group called Heels 2.0. It's a private public coalition formed in January to help come up with answers to address violent crime. One of the members of this group is Mark Osler, University of St. Thomas School Law Professor and a former federal prosecutor. He joins us in studio. Mark, thank you so much for coming in studio with us. First of all, explain to us what HEALS 2.0 is, how it was formed, and kind of how often you've been meeting and the things you're talking about.
Sure. This is a collaboration between County Attorney Mike Freeman and U.S. Attorney Andy Luger and a bunch of other people from the county, from the city. And, you know, you were just talking about political division and the problem with that. And it was an attempt to break through that and also break through some of the jurisdictional problems that we've had that have failed to allow for coordination to address what really is a serious problem in this city and in other cities across the country.
Hey there, Mark. It's Jordana. I'm here on the screen in front of you, not in studio, unfortunately.
Good morning.
But thank you for coming in and answering our questions. Now, HEALS, as Adam was talking about, it stands for Hope, Education, Law, and Safety. You know, this was started by Mike Freeman decades ago. This is, as Adam mentioned, the 2.0 version. What did they do wrong decades ago that they need to correct now? Why didn't it work?
Well, one of the things is that, you know, that was back in the 90s, and they focused on one neighborhood, the Phillips neighborhood. And actually, it did kind of work. It did, you know, we did see a reduction in crime. And we've seen a reduction in violent crime, not only here, but across the country over the past 30 years, pretty consistently. In some places, more than others. In Manhattan, for example, during that time period, you had homicides go down over 90%, which is pretty remarkable. And so what we're seeing, unfortunately, is crime coming back after something worked. Unfortunately, one of the problems that we have, and as a former prosecutor and a scholar, I'm sorry to say this, we don't know what caused the reduction in crime. There's a lot of theories, but it's very hard to measure. And that means that we struggle at times to figure out how to address this new increase. And that's why it was important to get a lot of voices together from the corporate world, from people who focus on data, victims, across the spectrum to talk about what can happen next. And we came up with some very specific ideas going forward.
What are those specific ideas?
Well, just to set a little context, one of the things with violent crime is that it is committed by a relatively small group of people, and then they tend to do it more than once. Think about carjackings. Not a lot of people are going around doing carjackings relative to the number of cars, but they tend to do it more than once. And that means that what we need to do is get those people who are doing it. That sounds incredibly simple, but it is hard to do sometimes. And there's two tactics that we came to focus on. And one is increase the clearance rate, solve more of these crimes. When we're looking at a carjacking clearance rate of about 12%, we're not doing it right. And so we have to find the people who are committing these crimes and bring them to justice. Homicide is a clearance rate of 38%. That is not even close to good enough. So the first thing is we need to solve more crimes. One thing about that I want to emphasize, too, is that what deters people from committing crimes isn't the length of sentence they might receive. Data shows that really consistently in Department of Justice data. What does deter crime is people perceiving they'll get caught. And that's why increasing the clearance rate is so important. The second tactic that we really focused on is executing outstanding warrants. A lot of people who are committing crimes, they already have a warrant for their arrest, outstanding. And unfortunately, what we've seen is the Minneapolis Police Department has shrunk and lost people. They've had to focus on 911 calls. They have to keep doing that. And that means that they've lost investigators, which hurts the clearance rate, and also people who go out and execute warrants, because you need a lot of people to do that. If you think about arresting someone who's suspected of an armed crime, you're not just going to send one guy out to do that. You need a team of people, and there's been a lack of resources to do that.
Mark, do you think solving, you mentioned solving the crimes, is the key to lowering the violence? And I understand we lost about 300 officers post the George Floyd murder, but is it just about hiring more, or is it about the training that the Minneapolis Police Department has? Do we need to retrain? Do we need better investigators? What's the key here?
Jordan, my answer is yes, yes, and yes. And there's another yes beyond that as well, because, of course, we need to fill the ranks. They've been down over 60 investigators, and that is a serious loss, given what I've just said. They do need to train people better, absolutely. But the thing, and this is something that Cedric Alexander, the new director of public safety, has been talking about. But here's the thing about that. Those are solutions for 2024. It's going to take a long time to hire people and to train them, even if we can talk people into taking the job, which we've kind of failed at doing. And that means we have to look at ways to achieve these goals in the short term, too, because people are dying. And that matters now as much as it will in 2024. So we have to look at other things to execute outstanding warrants, for example. One of the things that happened is there was a Marshals Task Force that specialized in that. And they were very good at finding people and arresting them, which, again, it's a dangerous, dangerous job. And it takes special training, and it takes a lot of bravery to do that, frankly. But that task force kind of fell apart and gone down from, I think, 20 people to 4, which isn't enough to execute warrants. And so one of the things that has come out of this initiative is rebuilding that task force to get on the streets to find the most dangerous people and bring them to justice.
Why did that task force fall apart like that? And, I mean, are those people still available to come back and, lack of a better term, hit the ground running and trying to find some of these folks?
Well, probably that's one of the problems that we're going to face is the staffing. Now, the Marshals Service isn't significantly down in the way that we've seen the Minneapolis Police Department down. And that's why the involvement of federal resources is so important. One of the problems that's happened, and, I talked about the cross-jurisdictional nature of a lot of this, is, there's been a dispute about body-worn cameras and what happens with the tape from that. That's something that we got to work out, because what's at risk is much more important than whatever that fight is about. And it is getting worked out. There has been movement, and so we're making progress.
Talk about the idea that, and I hear this all the time, oh, that people get arrested in Minneapolis and then they're right back on the street. We don't have the resources to keep them, in the jails. We're not hard enough on crime. Can you address that? I mean, is that true?
Not in the way that – certainly there's cases where that happens. People make bail and they get out. One thing that we have to recognize is that there's a constitutional right to bail in this state except for first-degree murder cases. And so that means that if people can make bail, they're going to get out. And we can change the Constitution perhaps to change that. But right now there's not only the right to bail in almost all cases, but the right to a reasonable bail, which means one that they're able to make. And so judges just don't have the power to, in most cases, say, well, you can't get out. to change that, we'd probably have to change the Constitution of the state.
Right.
Now, in terms of, you hear people saying, well, bail reform's the problem. Well, we haven't had significant bail reform in this state, so that's not the problem here. And in places where they did do bail reform, like Los Angeles, New York, and Houston in particular, they've done studies now over the impact of that, and bail reform and the changes to bail haven't been the problem. Now, a lot of times when you hear people talking about, someone got back out, really what's going on is they read that the person had an outstanding warrant. And that goes back to the point I made about what we need to do is execute those outstanding warrants for the most violent crimes.
We're talking to Mark Osler, who's a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, part of this HEALS 2.0 group, this private public coalition formed to try to come up with ways to combat violent crime. You mentioned it, too. It's a small group of people. So if they have outstanding warrants, let me just follow up on that, and they're picked up for something else, I mean, do those outstanding warrants lead them to be locked up longer? And, I mean, how do you How do you fight against the perception that a lot of people have that, you know, whether it's liberal judges, whatever they say, that these are judges who just are soft on crime?
Yeah, I mean, that's not what data shows, is that, you know, if we had much longer sentences, it wouldn't have an impact on crime because people age out of crime. You know, you don't have a 60-year-old who maybe was a member of a gang when he was 21 who gets out at 60 and commits violent crimes. And so, you know, these extremely long sentences, again, the idea that deterrence works isn't true with those very long sentences. And part of it is this. These people who are committing these crimes, they're not making rational cost-benefit analyses. You know, to really be deterred from doing the crime, you first would have to know about that potential sentence. And then second, do a rational cost-benefit analysis. And let's face it, that's not what these 18-year-olds are doing, is you know, calculating what a sentence they might get. So, you know, it really isn't about judges. In the end, it comes back to policing over and over and over.
What is the responsibility here of the community? Because I'm not... you know, I don't know if the task force, the HEALS task force, at least just what I was reading in the Strib, how much are they involving the community? I remember Don Samuels used to have a 7-point plan because he said most of the crime, as you mentioned, Mark, he agreed with you, was committed by a small number of people, and he knew the families that were involved. Where is the community factor in HEALS 2.0?
Well, we have members of the community that are involved. I had one working group, and one of the members of my working group is a woman named Julie Wickland, who was a victim of a violent crime. And that's a really important voice to hear, along with members of the city council, you know, mayors of suburban jurisdictions and the city here. You know, in terms of the community as a whole, one of the things that people have to be willing to do is work with the police. And that's been a part of the problem, is that, you know, I read once that what a principal problem with marriages that fail is people have contempt for one another. Once the two members of a marriage have contempt for one another, it's a lost cause. And unfortunately, right now, you have parts of the community that have contempt for the police. And frankly, you know, through things like what happened to George Floyd, it was earned. And there's been a history of the police having contempt for some people in the community. And that needs to be fixed and addressed. And that's a cultural problem that goes both ways.
Can you stay after the break here for another segment?
Absolutely.
Because on that note, I want to know why you and others should have hope for the city of Minneapolis on that note. Mark Osler is with us, law professor, University of St. Thomas, talking about what can be done to address the crime situation in the Twin Cities. 11:20, more with Mark after the break. Continuing our conversation with Mark Osler, law professor at the University of St. Thomas, former federal prosecutor who's part of this HEALS 2.0 group, looking at ways to battle the spike, the violent crime, the continued violent crime, specifically in Minneapolis. And Mark, I want to go back to your conversation about this U.S. Marshals Task Force, which would help immensely, as you point out, in finding these relatively small groups of individuals who are committing this crime. Is the issue, why? I guess, what is stopping that from happening right now?
Well, you know, after the death of Winston Smith in Uptown in 2021, that got a lot of press. And there was, at that time, marshals didn't wear body-worn cameras. That policy was changed later, that when they're working on task forces, they can. But there's a remaining question about who possesses the tape and things like that. You know, frankly, it sounds to me like bureaucracy that needs to get worked through immediately. And again, through the efforts of the U.S. attorney and people in the U.S. attorney's office, they are moving with urgency towards solving that problem. Because, again, this is a tough job. If you're busting down a door and you know there's a shooter with a warrant on the other side of that door, that's not a job for everybody. It's a specialized task that very few people are willing to take up. And so we need the best people out there on the street doing it.
So explain to me that correlation. You're saying more body-worn cameras. How does that benefit? Which side does that benefit? And how does that benefit stopping the more violent crime?
Well, it's really not related to that. It's, you know, the body-worn cameras, of course, are great for police accountability and things like that. Historically, what we've seen over the past 10 years is that more municipalities and counties are requiring officers to wear body-worn cameras. Mm-hmm. DOJ and its units resisted that for a long time. And so there was a disjuncture there.
I'm going to ask you this. I worked downtown every day, even through the pandemic, and obviously downtown changed a lot, and it's a lot better than it was in the depths of the pandemic, but there are still some people who have big issues with coming downtown. For me, during the day, I have no problem. Is there an element at night that I'd be worried about? Yeah, I'll be honest with you. So how do we get bullish on downtown returning to a normal situation? How do we have hope that this will be a safe place for everybody to come to no matter what time of day?
Yeah, it's going to be incremental. You know, it's going to change over time. And here's something to keep in mind is that one bad experience poisons people coming downtown, not only the person who has it, but everyone around them. You know, they go back to Eden Prairie and say, oh, you know, I was hassled by this guy trying to get to my car. But, you know, it takes a lot of good experiences to make up for that. And so that's what's got to happen, is there has to be a number of good experiences of people coming down to the Guthrie, people coming back to work at Target, people having, an evening where they have a good dinner, then they drive home. and mm-hmm. that's going to happen over time. And I think it's already starting to happen. But it's going to, because you've got that multiplier factor to the bad experiences, it's going to take a while.
Mark, if you could wave a magic wand and have sort of the perfect system in place to stop this violent crime, make downtown safer, describe what that would be for you.
Well, I mean, one thing that I would want to do is be able to provide services to people who need it. I mean, we can't ever get too far away from the fact that crime is usually rooted in poverty in one way or another. And sometimes in social disruptions like the COVID pandemic and what happened with juveniles during that pandemic. From a prosecutor, that may surprise you, but I think that's really important that a lot of the people who are out on the street, who we might perceive as being dangerous, aren't really dangerous. They're just having some issues. And so one thing I would want to do is be better at addressing that, because it's that perception of safety as much as safety that really matters. If we see someone who's wandering around and yelling into the air, I'm going to cross the street. In fact, I do cross the street. And that's something that people, have a bad experience with. And frankly, that person's having a bad experience too. And we need to do a better job on that. Now, in terms of the actual violent crime, I think that we need more resources. We need more social workers. Obviously, we need more investigators. We need to get people who are going to execute those warrants. And we need to find ways to do it. Again, if we want to hire into the Minneapolis Police Department, that needs to happen. But that's not going to matter until 2024 when those people are in trained. And that means that we need to find ways to get people into those positions now. And one of the things that our task force worked on, and this is starting to happen, is looking at ways to, for example, bring back retired federal investigators to work with the investigators in the Minneapolis Police Department. There already has been a really good effort with the BCA, the state investigators coming in and working on some of these homicides and these carjackings. And we need to piggyback on that and expand it.
Other than that happening, and we're up against the clock, so this might be the last question for you, but your recommendations, is there any mandate to do anything, whether it's the mayor, the Minneapolis City Council, or do they just look at this and say, thank you for the suggestions?
No, actually, we're already seeing some action on this, primarily through the federal agencies. I would like to see more from the city, and we need to have those discussions. My work isn't done here. You asked earlier about hope. I do have hope. I'm from Detroit. I was a federal prosecutor in Detroit. My first memory is the disaster there in 1967 when 2,000 buildings were destroyed. And for so long, it wasn't rebuilt. Here, we came together and have been rebuilding in a very different way. We need to bring that same community spirit to addressing the violent crime issue.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us in studio. Mark Osler, part of the crime task force that is urging Minneapolis to be more aggressive against violent crime, and professor as well. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
There's a lot of problems, Adam. There's a lot and a lot of solutions. So I am encouraged that people are thinking about this. And I know Mark said that we might not see results till 2024, but we have to have a plan and we have to be implementing now. Adam and I will be right back.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.